This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, as the Obama presidency is winding down, the president is taking on another public health issue, one that leads to more than 38,000 deaths per year in the country and 4.5 million injuries, traffic accidents.
Well, you know, the number of drunk driving crashes are down over the past several decades, thank heavens. But we are very much a driving nation committed to our cars, and increasingly, drivers are distracted, and often by their smartphones. Traffic fatalities increased last year by 7%, despite the strong seatbelt laws and good compliance with them, despite drunk driving laws, despite distracted driving laws that prohibit texting or using your phone while driving. So I know it's not very scientific, Mark, but based on what I see every day when I'm driving, I'd say there is something of a distracted driving epidemic.
Absolutely. I'm waiting for those driverless cars, Margaret. But the president has a pretty ambitious goal. He's aiming to end traffic fatalities within 30 years. The Department of Transportation is going to deploy more robust initiatives to bolster seatbelt laws, expand the use of rumble strips on the roadside, those divots that sound off when your tires drift over the line, and raising awareness about drunk and distracted driving and speeding.
Well, 94% of all traffic accidents are the result of human error. And so the president's looking ahead to the future growth of self-driving car technology, as you mentioned, to help support his agenda. And that technology is already in play. One bright spot, the advent of ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft have led to a sharp decline in drunk driving, and that is very good news on the driving front.
That really is. And speaking of advancing a big agenda, our guest today is tasked with helping to overhaul the Veterans Health Administration after a whistleblower revealed extremely long wait times at some VA facilities, which led to some devastating outcomes.
Dr. David Shulkin is the Undersecretary for Health at the VA. He's known for turning around failing medical facilities and improving the quality of care. He's got a big job ahead of him at the VA, which is the largest integrated health system in the entire country and serves the complex health needs of some 9 million veterans. We are looking forward to that conversation.
We are indeed. And Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, you can email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. David Shulkin in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Theranos is officially out of the lab testing business. The rising diagnostic startup led by Elizabeth Holmes, featuring technology that was shrouded in much secrecy and once valued at $9 billion, has been banned from the diagnostic business for 2 years after multiple problems were found. The company was founded on the promise that a comprehensive lab testing could be done with a finger prick and simple drop of blood instead of the vial typically taken out of the arm. Theranos announced it would lay off 340 people, just under half its workforce, and get out of the business of administering blood tests altogether, a business that's drawn much scrutiny from multiple government agencies. Holmes herself will stay on at the restructured company. Hurricane Matthew left quite a bit of devastation in its wake, and once the cleanup is underway, public health officials are worried about a number of potential threats. The rise of cholera in Haiti, which is an ongoing problem in that country since the devastating earthquake several years ago. Flooding caused by the hurricane will likely affect water and sanitation systems there, worsening the spread of the disease, which has already sickened more than 28,000 people this year. They're also concerned about a resurgence of Zika in the Caribbean islands that were hit as well as in Florida and the Bahamas. The Aedes mosquito that carries the virus needs just a tiny amount of water for breeding. And Venezuela, grappling with a deep economic crisis, is seeing the situation play out in the nation's public health. A severe shortage of vaccines and antibiotics has led to an increase in poor outcomes for sick and injured people in that country, as well as a resurgence of diphtheria, an infectious disease that is fatal in 10% of the cases, according to the World Health Organization. The disease has not been seen in Venezuela since 1992. Government officials have actually been turning away donated humanitarian aid. Officials deny there's a crisis underway. While the recent tale of the Flint, Michigan water crisis still lingers, there's actually some good news on the lead levels in kids' front. Levels have fallen dramatically in this country over the past 20 years. The numbers of kids between 1 and 5 with elevated lead levels dropped from 26% in 1988 to around 2% last year. However, racial disparities persist. Black children were twice as likely to have elevated blood levels than whites, linked largely to a poverty issue. Even a tiny amount can have lasting effects on a child's development over a lifetime. And call it a very thin silver lining, the soaring number of deaths due to overdose has had an impact on one challenging reality, the shortage of organs for people waiting on organ donor lists. There were 48,000 overdose deaths in 2014, far surpassing automobile accidents as the primary source for donated organs. Transplant surgeons are now screening organs from addicts, determining that even with the presence of something like hepatitis C, now a treatable condition, it still makes more organs available. Dozens of organs have been donated in New England from patients who had OD'd in the past year. Still, there are 120,000 people on organ donor wait lists nationwide. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with the Honorable Dr. David Chulkin, Undersecretary of Health at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, as Chief Executive Officer of Veterans Health Administration. Dr. Chulkin leads the nation's largest integrated healthcare system, serving the health needs of almost 9 million U.S. veterans. Dr. Chulkin is the former president and CEO of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City and served as Chief Medical Officer at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and the Medical College of Pennsylvania Hospital. A board-certified internist, Dr. Chulkin is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and has been named one of the 50 most influential physician executives in healthcare by Modern Healthcare. He received his medical degree from the Medical College of Pennsylvania, completed his internship at Yale University School of Medicine and his residency at the University of Pittsburgh Presbyterian Medical Center. Dr. Chulkin, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the work that you're doing at the Veterans Administration. You came in from the private sector to help out the VA tackle what I think most of the people knows is some very serious administrative problems and the long waiting times, delayed care. But the VA also serves admirably 9 million American veterans at 1,700 care sites and employs some 300,000 healthcare workers around the country. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners the sort of scope and complexity of the challenges you face in seeking to rectify some of those cultural embedded obstacles.
Well, Mark, thank you for allowing me to have a little time to share with you and your listeners today. The VA healthcare system is a vital healthcare system for not only America's veterans, but actually for all of American healthcare. I don't think most people realize this is the largest healthcare system in the country, and we can see the resources of the VA healthcare system being deployed around the country to the parts of the country that need it to help meet needs in times of emergencies. So we're the largest employer of doctors, nurses, largest number of hospitals in the country. But just to give you a size, we are the only healthcare system that is responsible for delivering care in every nook and cranny of this country, wherever a veteran lives, even if we don't have VA facilities there. So we work closely with community providers and do what it takes to be able to provide the veterans of this country the health care that they deserve.
Dr. Chulkin, let's talk about some of these challenges. Oh, I know a whistleblower called attention to the problem of the long wait lines in 2014, and there was an independent audit showing the problem was pretty pervasive. I think at that time, more than 57,000 veterans had been waiting 90 days or longer for new patient appointments across the country. And the VA really responded strongly to this long wait time issue with the program called Veterans Choice, really an innovation that allowed veterans to seek care outside the VA if they did face a long wait. But that program had a whole new set of administrative issues and challenges. Help us understand the intent of Veterans Choice and the challenges you encountered, and how is that faring now?
Well, first of all, I do have to say that what we now call the wait time crisis that happened in April 2014 was a significant challenge to the VA healthcare system. I, of course, came at the president's request after the crisis to bring my private sector experience to the VA to try to focus and address the solutions of access in healthcare. And so this has been my number one priority. Congress actually gave us the CHOICE program as an additional tool, but you have to remember that the VA has for years and years provided about 20% of its care in the community already to supplement the VA healthcare system. And the CHOICE program was supplemental funding provided by Congress to be able to do this. As you said, the CHOICE program was filled with administrative complexity, and the VA healthcare system had 90 days from the passage of the CHOICE program to implement a nationwide new program. And I think that we all know now in retrospect that to do a program of this size and scope, that it probably needed to take longer than 90 days. But we've worked through many of those problems as we've increased our authorizations of care in the community over fourfold in the past year, which means that it's working better. We're taking care of more veterans. But it still is a program that's far too complex and too burdensome. So we've asked Congress to make major changes in the program so it works better for veterans. And that legislation is pending for a congressional vote, we hope.
You know, speaking of complexities, veterans face a whole host of medical issues that are unique to their service. Perhaps one of the most pervasive is post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think it's really difficult for non-veterans to understand the depth of the challenge. An estimated 20% of veterans face lingering effects of PTSD and other mental health issues. And the VA has made a dedicated commitment to confronting the epidemic. It's estimated that 20 veterans are committing suicide every day. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the VA's targeted effort in addressing the crisis, and also how does President Obama's campaign to improve mental health access for vets and their family come into play here?
Yeah. I think starting with what is clearly an unacceptable situation is the place to start this discussion, and that's the 20 veterans a day who are taking their life. It's just a horrific number, unacceptable, and really one of our areas of top focus to address this. When you look into that number, and there are 20 veterans a day taking their life, only six of them are getting care within the VA healthcare system. That means there are 14 a day who are out there potentially disconnected from the best resources that can help them and address their care. So one of the things that we are doing very diligently is reaching out to as many community organizations as we can, and reaching out to churches and other groups and friends and family of veterans, and making sure that they know that if they see a veteran that is isolated or potentially in crisis, to make sure that they are utilizing the resources that are available in the VA, particularly our Veterans Crisis Line, which is open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. What we're doing needs to be much more than that. And we have over 300 suicide prevention coordinators who do nothing every day but work to address this issue. We are implementing a research tool that actually predicts, uses our data to analytically predict those at highest risk for suicide, and proactively reaching out to those veterans and making sure that we can offer them resources, help, and assistance. And so we have a number of different programs to try to address this, because it is such a critical issue, not only for veterans, but really for all Americans, where the crisis in suicide really has reached what I would call epidemic levels.
Well, Dr. Shulkin, let me ask you first, you know, related to mental health, but also an independent risk factor is the problem of homelessness among our veteran population. And I think the stat on this is in 2014, which is a couple of years ago now, there were an estimated 50,000 homeless veterans across the country. And yet, just in the past year even, I've heard some reports of significant progress in some states, including our own, about particularly targeting homeless vets and reducing and getting closer to ending homelessness. Talk to us a little bit, if you would, about some of the demographics of homeless veterans. How are they different from the veteran population as a whole? And tell us about the program the VA and states across the country have to try and mitigate this problem.
Well, I think this is an area that I hope all Americans are proud of the efforts that are going on. One of the unique things about the VA healthcare system is that it not only focuses on the physical health issues of our veterans, but actually focuses in on the social issues, the psychological issues, and the economic issues. And as a physician, you can't really address a person's health and well-being if they don't have a home. And so VA has really focused on this. And over the last 4 years, we have reduced veteran homelessness across the country by 46%. Hmm. And that means that we've housed hundreds of thousands of veterans and their families. But as you know, the issue of homelessness is a chronic problem. More and more veterans continue to find themselves economically challenged and find themselves in this situation. In fact, we were just with a group of veterans recently in the South that were homeless, and all of them actually had jobs. Hmm. But at minimum wage, yep. they weren't able to afford housing. We're working with the Housing and Urban Development federal officials. We're working with local builders and real estate landlords to try to find affordable housing for those that need it. And certainly our goal is to end veteran homelessness. States like Connecticut that you're mentioning have really done a terrific job mm-hmm. in pulling together state, local, and federal resources to be able to actually end homelessness among veterans.
We're speaking today with the Honorable Dr. David Shulkin, Undersecretary of Health at the U.S. Veterans Affairs Department and the Chief Executive of the Veterans Health Administration. Dr. Shulkin leads the nation's largest integrated healthcare system, serving the 9 million U.S. veterans. Dr. Shulkin, you have a national reputation in transforming healthcare, and prior to the VA, you were credited with turning Beth Israel Medical Center around, and yet you took a 90% pay cut to join the VA, so it was really obviously about service. But I'd love to hear from you of what motivated you to take on the challenges, and also the larger task of transformation. What are the building blocks for success as you think about moving a very large ship in a different direction?
I'd like to think that I'm no different than any other American. As I was watching now over 2.5 years ago, the wait time issues mm-hmm. play out over national TV and newspapers, watching as we saw that veterans weren't getting their health care needs met, I was as outraged as most Americans. What I didn't realize is that in a few weeks, I would be getting a phone call from the White House asking whether I would be willing to step up and be part of the solution and help fix it. How can you say no? Mm-hmm. These are people who have put their lives on the line to protect our freedoms. This is a obligation that all of us as citizens have. So I left my position, and here I am. And I hope that all of my experience that I've brought to the table is helpful in transforming the VA in the way that you described.
Well, Dr. Shulkin, I know you're a practicing internist, but you've also spent time in your career teaching. And I'm not sure that many people outside of healthcare know that the VA is actually the largest organization training health profession students in the country. So I know you've been engaged in an initiative at the VA to recruit heavily to make sure that you have the clinical staffing, and we've collaborated nationally with some of the leaders in developing your postgraduate nurse practitioner residency programs. And talk with us a little bit about the scope of health professions training in the VA.
Yeah, one of the questions that I hear quite frequently is, you know, why do we need the VA system? Why not just give out a voucher uh-huh. system? And people may not realize the other things that the VA healthcare system does for the country. One of those is we train over 120,000 health professionals mm. every year in the VA system. We are the largest trainer, as you said, of doctors, nurses, physical therapists, pharmacists, social workers. If it was not for the VA healthcare system, there would not be the supply mm-hmm. of healthcare professionals for the rest of America. It is said that 70% of U.S. physician medical students go through the VA during part of their training. I know in my training, I went through 3 VA medical centers, mm-hmm. and that's where I gained the valuable experience that I was able to bring out into the private sector. Without the size and scope of our training programs, much of what we see out in the rest of the country wouldn't be possible. As you mentioned, I do still practice internal medicine. I practice in the VA system now. I think it's really important that I stay close to what's happening, and I interact with these trainees and these students mm-hmm. when I practice. Interestingly, I practice both in person, but I also practice in Grants Pass, Oregon, from my office here in Washington, D.C., overlooking the White House, using telemedicine.
Fantastic.
And what people don't recognize is VA is very technologically advanced, the largest user of telemedicine in the country by far. And this is another thing that we expose our trainees to. So they come out of the VA system knowing how to use electronic medical records, knowing how to use telehealth, knowing how to use these advanced technologies, and they bring that skill to the rest of American medicine.
Well, I'd like to pull the thread a little on that, because on one hand, you're trying to make sure the VA is an efficient, effective, and hopefully an elegant healthcare delivery system, a world-class system, and you were just talking about engaging in new delivery systems. The president has a new precision medicine initiative that's out there. Where do you see the role of precision medicine, genomics, and the like being rolled out in the Veterans Administration?
Well, I think under the president's leadership, we've really embraced this type of medicine as the future of where healthcare is going, how we can do a better job to treat veterans and all Americans. VA has played a central role not only in precision medicine, but in the moonshot efforts, which the vice president leads in order to help find and advance our care and curing of patients who have cancer. One of these other things that makes VA unique is our research. We provide over $1.6 billion of research every year dedicated specifically to advancing the health of veterans. So no other organization does that. And one of the areas that VA leads in is we have the world's largest database of genomic material, doing sequencing on the materials of over 1 million veterans, and today have the largest database in the world of this type of genomic data that we can match up with our electronic medical record. And so we're doing studies to advance cancer care and care for PTSD and traumatic brain injury and mental health, all in a way that no other organization in the country is able to do at this point. And so our commitment to precision medicine, our leadership in precision medicine, we believe is yet another example of why VA is so critical for not only veterans, but all of American healthcare.
Well, Dr. Shulkin, I think we all in healthcare have benefited from that, and also your work in healthcare delivery system redesign, your patient care aligned teams, so many areas that I think have really been a benefit to everybody in healthcare. So thank you for that. Just one more innovation. We'd like to check in with you on the Blue Button Initiative, the online electronic health portal where veterans can access their health data, something most of us in healthcare are still trying to figure out what's the secret sauce to getting people to use the portal. What's your research and utilization and delivery system study showing you in that arena?
One of the very early innovators of electronic medical records was VA.
Of course.
30 years of history now of using this. And so what we've been working on is interoperability of sharing of information. So VA is participating in hundreds of these health information exchanges around the country because our veterans are getting care both within the system and outside the system. And we've been trying to innovate in this area. The Blue Button, of course, was one of those innovations. But we have a whole team called the U.S. Digital Team that was actually one of the president's initiatives to bring people from Silicon Valley. We have a whole team helping us design many of these innovations in a similar way. We're just launching a website called vets.gov, which will be a single source of information. Now, you have to go to multiple websites and you have to know the right numbers to call, but vets.gov will be the single source where people can access all information on veteran services. So we continue to try to innovate in this area.
We've been speaking today with the Honorable Dr. David Shulkin, Undersecretary of Health at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the nation's largest integrated healthcare system, serving the health needs of almost 9 million U.S. veterans. You can learn more about their work by going to va.gov, or you can follow them on Twitter at Veterans Health. Dr. Shulkin, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations in Healthcare.
Sure,
today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In the vice presidential debate, Republican Mike Pence implied that Hillary Clinton was wrong when she cited the fatal shooting of an African-American man by an African-American cop as a case of implicit or unconscious bias. But scientific research shows African-Americans are not immune to this form of bias against members of their own racial group. In his criticism of Clinton, Pence was referring to the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott by Officer Brentley Vinson on September 20th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Both men are African American. Pence asked, why would Hillary Clinton accuse that African American police officer of implicit bias? To be clear, Clinton didn't directly accuse Vinson of implicit bias. But regardless, Pence was wrong in implying that African Americans can't be subject to implicit bias of other African Americans. According to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, implicit bias refers to relatively unconscious and relatively automatic features of prejudice, judgment, and social behavior. Implicit bias is opposed to explicit bias, or judgments a person consciously holds. In other words, it's possible for a person to explicitly believe that white and black Americans should be treated equally, but implicitly judge situations counter to that explicit belief. The group has looked at a variety of biases, including those concerning racial issues, and found even numbers of black respondents showing a pro-white bias as show a pro-black bias. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Catherine Couch is a self-taught chef with a love of organic foods and a penchant for helping people in need. After launching her own meal delivery service in Northern California, she often encountered a particular kind of client, someone battling a serious illness who was just too tired or too sick to prepare nutritious food just when they needed it most.
What happens when people get diagnosed with a serious health problem is their life becomes very stressful. And especially for cancer patients, you also don't feel like eating. And so food, at the moment when it needs to be really, really important for many people, drops to the bottom of the priority list for a whole host of reasons. And on the other side, we're raising a generation of young people that don't know how to prepare food and don't understand the power that food has in their own life, but also for the life of the community and for the environment.
Couch is driven by the idea that food is medicine, especially for somebody who's suffering the toxic side effects of chemotherapy. When a friend asked if she would employ her teenage daughter in her kitchen for a summer, she stumbled on a way to grow her enterprise, hire teenage workers, use professional chefs to train them to cook healthy meals with organic ingredients, and place the power of healing with food into their hands. She launched the Ceres Project, named after the goddess of agriculture and fertility. She expanded her kitchen facilities and started hiring dozens of local teenagers, many of whom had never cooked or held a job. And she says the transformation in these kids is just amazing.
They walk into a situation where people are being the best of who they can be. They're invited into that. They're given an opportunity to be an owner and to make a real difference in someone's life. We have this rich resource in our community of teenagers who are actually longing to be given real opportunities to contribute. So it's a win-win on all those levels. And at the same time, they're all learning how to cook and eat healthy food. And they understand that, you know, when they buy organic carrots instead of eating processed chips, that they're actually making the environment better.
Couch has since grown her enterprise from her home base in Sonoma County to Marin County in Northern California. And she has been contacted by interested organizations around the country that seek to replicate the program. The Ceres Project earned Couch a CNN Heroes Award. But the real reward, she says, she experiences in everyday encounters, in the hundreds of teens that she's trained and in the thousands of clients that they have served healthy meals to during a time of need.
We do a block where clients come in every day and talk about what it was like to be diagnosed and what their journey has been like as they've been sick and the difference that the food has made for them. And it includes sometimes people who know they're terminal. It includes sometimes partners who've lost their partner
who come in and talk about the difference that the kids made for their partner at the end stage of life. And there's a lot of tears that happen in that room, and it's very profound.
A program that trains young people in the art of healthy cooking, using those skills to feed those suffering from serious illness who might otherwise face malnutrition, empowering empathy in the kids, helping others to fight illness in the process. These are all bright ideas. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.